This show is a proud member of the Nerdy Legion Podcast Network. Get more at nerdylegion.com.
Welcome to the Aftershock Central Podcast with Martin and Travis. Ronnie is out on assignment today. Actually, we don't know where Ronnie is. Let's be real.
Is he okay?
Yeah, he's fine. He's fine.
All right, if anybody sees Ronnie, just tweet at us. Make sure we know he's okay.
I think he's partying. I think he went to the Cardinals game yesterday, and I don't know, maybe he had too much fun.
It's turned into a whole thing. He'll check in a week. He's been on a bender the whole time.
Yeah. Well, the man needs a break. He does 300 podcasts.
That's true.
So it's fine. We're not here to talk about Ronnie, though. We're here to talk about Aftershock. And I think we should kick off talking about this new book that was announced, The Moth and Whisper. It's coming out in September. This is written by Ted Anderson with art by Jen Hickman. And depending on which comic book website you find the announcement is what synopsis you'll get kind of on this book. The synopsis sounds cool. It's the kid of two thieves, and these people have disappeared apparently, but their spirit lives on because their kid is pretending to be both of them. And like I said, depending on what site you visit, for some of them it seems to be a straight up a spy thriller kind of thing. Some websites I know talked quite a bit about the fact that this is a, what did they call it? It wasn't transgender, gender equal maybe character, gender fluid,
gender queer, maybe queer.
I don't know. It was weird.
Yeah, I mean that aspect of it sounds cool. I wonder if from a story perspective, there's a reason why the character has to kind of take up both mantles. Or if it really is just an identity thing, because one of the synopses that I read really, I think, was leaning on the concept of identity, and especially in the concept of this kind of sci-fi premise, basically your identity is owned by corporations. Yep. Like the corporation where you live or whatever, they own your identity or something. So, that's tied into secret identity and wearing a mask, and identity is very much tied to gender as a concept. If they dig into that, I guess I'm very interested how much they'll explore into that, because I really enjoyed Alters.
Yeah, right.
Which again kind of gets to the nature of identity and gender, and through the lens of superhero comics. So it could be interesting. I guess I have a little bit of a pause as far as it being I saw it described as a YA title.
Yep, saw that.
Yeah, so I don't know what to expect as far as that goes. Obviously it's a young protagonist, so if that's why it's YA, then that's, I'm fine with that.
You could maybe say that that Alters was kind of a YA title also.
Yeah,
so I mean, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's, I don't know, I think sometimes when that's the one thing I hate about when they say, oh, YA book, or try to bill it as this, that, or the other. I think for some people it turns them off from actually giving the book a shot. And just because it says YA doesn't mean that all dudes aren't going to enjoy reading the book. You know what I mean? I try to be as diverse as I can in my comic reading, so I'm going to be picking it up, obviously. But I kind of wish I didn't know that it was a YA book. So we'll see.
Well, I wonder if that's just an indicator, almost a rating thing, because obviously,
yeah, maybe
so a fair amount of Aftershock books are what you would probably call mature, there's occasional nudity and extreme violence and profanity, it all makes it into certain titles.
Yeah.
So whether it's just a kind of indicator that teens can read this too, mm-hmm. Parents need not be concerned, or whether it really kind of gets into the Riverdale type, YA tropes, you know, like, I don't know. That I'm less interested in that, but I'm cool if it's just, like, for more or less all ages.
Yeah, that's kind of what I mean, right? I think when I think YA, I think of, like, high school romance type stuff. And that doesn't interest me in any way, shape, or form. So we'll see. The I mean, the art looks really cool. They showed a couple of preview pages. I dig the art style. It doesn't seem like the art style that I would normally see in a book geared towards a younger audience. But yeah, I look forward to seeing how this goes. It comes out in September, and we'll see. We'll see. I'm holding my breath until I actually read it.
Yeah, I think the art looks great. Agreed. So that's enough to be interested, I think.
Absolutely. Any other news, or should we get to the books?
Let's get into it, man.
All right, let's get into it. We didn't record last week, so we had two books we want to talk about from last week. We're going to do it very briefly, because I'm sure by now everyone's already read the books. And then we'll move on to this week's titles. So last week we had Pestilence, Son of Satan, number 1, and we had Brilliant Trash, number 6, which is the final issue. Let's do Pestilence first. Just briefly, I really like the new direction of this. I briefly talked about this book on my other podcast, and I thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed it. It's same creative team on this one, so that's always a big plus. Frank Thierry and Oleg Okunev. And yeah, I thought it was a nice entry into a new volume. Because if you hadn't read the first volume, I think they did a pretty good job at catching people up a little bit. You get to see that the cardinal that became Pope. You learn a little bit about the zombie apocalypse and how they solved it. You get to learn, obviously it's like a fast forward thing, so we advance a couple of years. You get to learn about what the Fiat Lux have been up to over the last few years, which is curing zombies across Europe. And yeah, it was cool. I thought it was really well done.
Well, like the Fiat Lux, I mean, I think at this point, you know, you have old Fiat Lux or whatever that's following around. I think I forget the name, Price maybe, like, or the dude who's, yes, carrying the Grail.
Right.
But he gets murdered by people that also call themselves Fiat Lux, you know? So I think my reading of that is that the Fiat Lux now, like, works for the Pope. And, you know, so they go after the dude who's curing zombies.
Yep.
I think the question maybe is how much this other storyline is tied to Pope, you know, like this storyline with Sir Richard, who, you know, now he's possessed by the devil. And basically the devil is like, oh, the whole zombie thing, that was like phase one.
Yeah.
And basically... That's like kind of a prelude to, like, it makes possible this other thing that he's trying to do. And I'm guessing for like what that could be is just that they kind of in this like zombie support group or whatever, they kind of are talking to these people and they're like, I remember being a zombie and I liked eating people.
Yeah.
You know? So that's step one to them being like, oh, and I'll just follow you, like Satan, or, you know, like whoever is in Sir Richard. And I guess I'm a little vague about how these people that now seem to be possessed differ from the zombies that we saw before. And again, how this ties into the Pope, who we know is, you know, like potentially about to be assassinated by Roderick or somebody in his camp.
Yep.
I assume we'll see how that progresses in the coming issues.
Yeah, I thought it was really well done, though. I like the introduction of Satan to kind of up the game a little bit. So it makes me wonder what they're going to use now to get rid of this plague, right? Because, I mean, using the Holy Grail as a weapon in the first volume... That's kind of like a heavy hitter weapon, right? What's going to be the bigger thing beyond that? And I do like the thriller aspect of it, you know, knowing that part of this all happened because this guy wanted to be Pope. And, you know, it actually led him to become Pope. And, you know, you mentioned the multiple factions of the Fiat Lux. I thought that was kind of cool. We'll see. But I think overall, it was a really solid first issue on this volume, too.
Yeah, I mean, I'm very curious, I think, just as far as who is narrating, you know, because, like, that was a device in the first series. The whole thing was kind of told in flashback via journal, and you're like, oh, it's Roderick, and he's like, writing a thing for his son in case he dies. But, like, we don't know for sure that this is Roderick now. We don't see his face in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm kind of wondering if it's Roderick's son or some kind of crazy twist or something, like, since it's obscured, but sure. You know, I guess we'll have to see.
Yep, I agree. Let's write this one up real quick. I think I gave this originally a 4 out of 5, and I'm gonna stick with that.
Yeah, 4 out of 5 sounds good. It's definitely a good start. So I'm curious where they're going with it.
All right, Brilliant Trash number 6. This is written by Tim Seeley with art by Steve Kurth. And if I'm not mistaken, this is a different artist, right?
I did not notice.
I didn't look it up, and I maybe should have, because when I was reading the book, it didn't feel like the same art style that we had in previous issues. And I could be wrong, but I actually really liked the art quite a bit in this book. I don't know if there was something different done with it, but I'm pretty sure Steve Kurth was not the original artist. Real quick on Brilliant Trash. Again, this is the final issue. I think it wrapped things up, but I'm not sure if it wrapped up the story that we've been reading, if that makes sense. Because we learned a lot about, like, all these other people with abilities. We learned about this, the Diddy virus, is out in the open. But did we see any of the characters that have been kind of key in this miniseries and this final issue?
No, I think that they more or less probably none of them survived into the last issue. Yeah. You know, aside from the one Capricorn that we saw in the first issue.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, so this issue really, I think, is kind of, you know, it's, you know, the culmination maybe of like what they were building to as far as the plot of the series. I, you know, as for whether that's like a satisfying ending, you know, probably we can discuss. I feel like just in broad strokes that this is kind of a series that tries to discuss a lot of things. Like, there's a lot of ideas, you know. I just don't know that they give enough attention to any single idea.
Yeah, right.
So it kind of, there's just a lot. Lot flying around, you know, like, for instance, you know, the central premise, you know, like, seemed to be initially that Dr. Zen was like, we got to give humanity a choice, you know, like you can have these superpowers and you choose, like, whatever, do you want to use them to help the world or whatever? And then, you know, where the reveal is that kind of like you just get infected with this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not a choice, you know, like none of these people had the choice to get the virus. They just came down with it and then they choose what to do with it, which, by the way, seems to be chaos.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, most of the people that have the stuff are using it for unproductive stuff or straight up, you know, like antisocial, counterproductive uses. So it was not necessarily the best kind of indicator of where this altruistic scientific like philosophy was headed, you know.
Right.
And you know, like, I also, you know, they kind of super briefly in this issue hint at an idea of, again, that, like, California is no longer part of the United States, and you now have this weird labor immigration thing where, you know, people are sneaking into California to try to work. But that was so, you know, shallowly examined. Like, I feel like it was more of a distraction to kind of put little pieces of that, but not really explain what it is or what it's supposed to mean. You know, like I feel like they tried to do a lot. They put a lot of ideas into here, but less ideas and more focus probably would have done a better job.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. this book is definitely about big ideas, and I'm not sure that it answers any of the questions that it aims to propose. I did actually enjoy the issue. By the way, I looked it up, and this is a different artist from the previous five issues. The previous five was Priscilla Petrades, so I don't know what the deal was, but different artist for this one. And I think that's fine. It was obvious to me when I read it, and now it makes sense. I think, wasn't Priscilla... No, that was Lilalise. She had a similar art style to Priscilla. Yeah, I dug the art. I dug the little vignettes that were told here. And I think maybe if this book was maybe marketed a little bit differently, I would feel differently about the book. Because I think, for me, this final issue was really solid. If it had been, if it was like one of the, like an anthology type book, right? If it was like Astro City, where they tell different hero stories every like issue or two. And there's like recurring themes, but you focus on different aspects of Astro City with each issue. If this series had been marketed as that, I think it would have been stronger for me. I don't know if it would have been stronger, like in terms of getting people interested in reading it. But you know, as a final issue for the story that we've had so far, I think it kind of fell by the wayside a little bit. But you know, it is what it is, I guess.
It's kind of almost like to your point about where are the main characters? Mm-hmm. It's almost like it was intended to end with the end of the last issue, you know?
Yeah, quite possibly.
So this is, it almost feels like an aftermath issue where you're like, well, what happened after that?
Yep. But see, the aftermath I really enjoyed. And I would have much rather see more of this kind of stuff. Anyways, let's write this one up. I'll let you go first on this one.
I'll go 3.25 out of 5.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely liked certain pieces of it. But yeah, like again, kind of as far as what to take away from it, I'm struggling a little bit.
Yeah, I'm with you.
I'm with you in general.
I'm gonna go 3 out of 5 on this one. It was a good read, and like I said, I really enjoyed this last issue. It just didn't feel like it was a part of the overall story, and that's probably okay. Let's go to this week's books. We have three books to talk about. We've got Dark Arc number 7, Cold War number 5, and Shipwreck number 6. So where do you want to start?
Do you want to do Dark Arc?
All right, Dark Arc number 7. This is the first... Is it the first issue of the second volume? Or was that 6? No, this is the first one. Cullen Bunn, writer, Wando on art, continuing the saga of the crazy Noah's Ark story. Told from a different perspective. We were introduced to Noah's Ark in the last issue, and with this issue we get a little bit more, and we learn, I guess, answers to one of the questions that we've had since the beginning: how do these other people get on the Ark, the people that are tied up? And I thought there was some emotional stuff in this particular issue. I dug the flashback stories going back to before the Flood. And, you know, with Shrey's daughter, how she's gathering supplies, and how, you know, we've seen her protect these people in this series. And now we see from the beginning why she's so adamant in protecting these people. Because while they're being used for food for these monsters on the Ark now, the reason that they were allowed on the Ark is because they helped Shrey and his family build the Dark Ark. And so, you know, by her logic, they should be protected. But by Shrey's logic, he already did what he promised. He promised that he would save him from the Flood, and he did. He didn't promise anything afterwards. It just so happens that he feeds them to monsters, you know? Whatever. Minor technicality, I guess.
Yeah, seems a little dishonest, you know. Technically, it's correct, but... Yeah, it's kind of messed up, dude.
Well, yeah, I'm not saying it's not messed up, but we know this guy is not a nice guy, right?
Yeah, I mean, he's in it to save his family, right? Like, that's kind of like what Shrey has been dealing with the whole time, and that's why he agreed to do it, I guess. I'm interested since he's talking about the flashback part of it, kind of the bombshell in this issue, I guess, that Callie is Noah's daughter, you know?
Right.
And so Noah is making his own arc, you know, and somehow or other, Callie ends up on Shrey's arc,
mm-hmm.
you know? So whether she takes their side or she does something that, you know, like Noah casts her out or something, like you're no longer welcome on our arc, you know, at the same time, you kind of have a scenario where, you know, people in the town clearly are making sacrifices to monsters or demons or whatnot. You know, so it's a very unsavory place. And Noah himself is making sacrifices on the open sea to this monster.
Yep.
You know, so I guess that opens up a question of really what's up with Noah. Is he like the upstanding character that you would assume? But also, I think from a larger perspective, you have to wonder about what is the deal with the sea monster, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, it's not working for the devil, because the devil wants Noah's Ark to survive. Right. And I assume it's not working for God, because God just seems to be uninvolved, you know?
Yeah, God doesn't care at all.
Yeah, so what, like... So whether this sea monster or whatever is just a third party or something, you know, who's kind of like screwing stuff up, I'm very curious how that fits into everything, especially now we see that like they're kind of setting up a deal between the monster and with Shrey
mm-hmm.
to save Noah's Ark.
Yeah, so Shrey sends Krul to Noah's Ark to investigate this monster and try to make a deal. And as a result, if Krul is successful, he'll get to do whatever he wants with Janris, I think is the girl's name. I still don't understand like what that relationship is. Like, does he just want this girl to eat her, or does he like want to be in a relationship with her? That's the one thing I don't understand. Because I'm still unsure about what kind of monster Krul is. Like it looks like he may be like a sphinx.
I think he's a manticore.
Oh, he's the manticore. That's right. Yeah, that's right. So I don't know. I don't understand the what his obsession is with this one girl.
Yeah, and is that Noah's daughter, or is that a different character?
Janris is the girl that Kali meets when she's out like looking for like roots and plants and stuff.
Okay, and that's Noah's daughter, right?
Janris?
Yeah.
Maybe.
I thought that was what I was taking away from it, which if like that was my assumption again, and that makes it more interesting, in fact, that she's kind of a bargaining chip between a few different parties, you know, mm-hmm. like Krul on the one hand, and maybe Noah, if she is his daughter. Like, I'm curious if that is the case, where that might be leading, you know, because I think it was a choice to put it in this issue.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I don't know. That's a good question. I mean, maybe, I don't know. That's not something I looked up. I hadn't even thought about it, to be honest with you.
Maybe I'm just putting stuff together, but I thought that Noah's daughter was like the one who's like Krul's favorite, you know. And yeah, like what is his fascination with her? Like definitely seems to be weird at best.
Extremely weird. Especially now, wasn't his mate killed early on? So like he's the only manticore there on the Ark.
Was the female manticore killed?
I thought she was. Because we haven't seen her, have we?
We saw her a few issues ago, but I don't remember what all happened and the intervening issues. I thought that she was still alive, but she definitely, the last time we saw her, was real frustrated with Krul, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, he's got this other piece on the side or whatever that he's getting distracted with, and she's not even a manticore.
Yep, it's very true. Very, very true. Yeah, I think the stuff with Noah is really interesting. We, you know, we saw the angels, what, last issue or two issues ago? And it was obvious that they don't want to be here. And I think with the way that Noah's praying to God and he's talking to his son Shem, and Shem's like, you know, why is God doing this to us? Like, there's this monster. We've thrown dozens of animals overboard to feed him, and like, he's still hanging out. And Noah's like, look, we'll just continue to pray to God. He's going to answer our prayers. And obviously that's not happening, right? Because it's pretty obvious from this story that God doesn't care, which leads to the question of, well, why are we having this flood? Like, did God actually talk to Noah? And maybe what's really going on is God maybe was bored. He's like, eh, let's just do this thing and see what happens, you know? Or maybe it was the devil or whatever being is talking to Shrey that set this whole thing up. I don't know. There's a lot of unanswered questions still. But I think the way that the story keeps on progressing, it continues to be interesting, right? We're like, even if you don't get those answers, you're fine continuing the story itself.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, you know, like that's part of what keeps it interesting. For my part, I think I'm curious, maybe, like, to your point, whether what if, like, both ships were sent by the devil, you know? Because, like, clearly, like, the men in town or whatever are bad, you know? They're sacrificing stuff to demons. So you could see maybe a thing where God is just like, no clean slate, and the devil's like, okay, but, you know, maybe I'll, like, set up these two arcs and, like, not tell them about each other or whatever, you know? I don't know. Yeah, like I'm certainly invested. I'm interested where the story is going to go because I assume that it'll all be addressed.
Mm-hmm. Agreed. All right, let's rate this one up. I'm going to give this one a 4 out of 5. I'm continuing to love this book.
Yeah, I'll go 4 1/4 out of 5.
Nice.
Yeah, I mean, dude, like I really like the kind of the flashback stuff in this issue and last issue that really starts to contextualize, you know, other pieces of the story, especially regarding this character. So, so hopefully we get more of that and it just maybe keeps opening up.
Yep. Cool. Let's see. I guess I'll pick the next one. Let's go to Cold War number 5. This is the final issue written by Chris Sabella with art by Hayden Sherman. And I really like this little robot kid.
Polly?
Yeah, Polly was freaking awesome.
Yeah, dude, like, she definitely kind of came onto the scene with a bang in the last issue, right?
Yeah, well, literally.
Yeah, like, it was clear, like, oh, like, here's one that works and it kicks ass. So, yeah, that's new.
Yeah.
Yeah, and she's a gamer, I guess. Like,
she is a gamer.
Kind of like a genius gamer, like maybe lawnmower man type or something. That's just like, oh, like not only am I a gamer, but also I'm a hacker, and you know that makes me Neo.
Yeah, but you know at the same time she's got a. It is a she, right?
I think so.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it is. She's got a pretty interesting and tragic backstory, also. And I would say one of the more interesting backstories out of all the characters we've seen, aside from maybe like Vin, I think Vin's story really grabbed me when that was shown in the flashback. But basically what happened was Polly had a terminal illness and her dad was trying to cure it and got her involved in the program to like cryogenically freeze her and created like all this other stuff for her because she couldn't go outside. She was like a girl in a bubble, right? Which is interesting because in the future, she pretty much still is the girl in the bubble. Her mind is inside this giant robot, or her head is in this giant robot. But if we go back to the present, our present, she couldn't go anywhere, couldn't do anything. And so her dad basically created this virtual reality world for her where she could actually have interactions with people and do things that she normally couldn't do because of her illness. And I thought that was really interesting because it's kind of one of those sci-fi tropes that pops up here and there. But I thought it was really well done in this particular story. Matter of fact, wasn't that one of the plot points in the new Blade Runner movie?
I haven't seen the new Blade Runner movie yet. All right.
I'm not going to spoil it then.
Thank you, because I could spoil other things in talking about this issue, but I'm going to restrain myself as well. Different IP, but we'll use the same restraint.
Fair enough. So yeah, I really liked her story, and of course that whole thing. I think what made this issue great for me is her backstory directly plays into how we wrap up this miniseries, because the only way really to save any of these people is for Polly to take their memory chips into herself and place them all into her virtual reality world that was created for her.
Yeah, dude. And also, I was so stoked to see that payoff of the whole Memtech thing, mm-hmm. You know? Like, the thing that's been a very significant device in every issue of the thing, every issue of the series so far, that's been front and center throughout each issue.
Yeah.
So to have that be like, oh, and then they take that thing and they plug it into this AI thing, and now the kind of memories will persist, you know, like it all exists inside an AI or whatever. I was pretty gratified by that.
I totally agree. It was well done, and it was nice to see these people that we've been with in the previous four issues get kind of a happy ending, right? Because none of them asked to be in this place. Well, except I guess maybe those two people in that cult, like maybe they asked to be here, but nobody else did. And in some ways, this was like a purgatory for them until they found Polly, and Polly kind of like takes them to heaven. And I thought that was nice, right? Because it was taking some religious concepts and twisting them around a little bit to make them make sense in a futuristic sci-fi story.
I hadn't thought of that, actually, because I was personally very confused with, you know, certain stuff, especially in this issue that they introduced as far as explaining what's going on, you know? Specifically, they kind of make a significant reference in the issue to that. They're like, why are they doing this or whatever? It's like, oh, so they can steal our money, like something along those lines or whatever.
That's exactly
because you know, like hundreds of years elapse or whatever, and interest keeps going, and so like that's all it takes to amass an enormous fortune or whatever. Yep. But you know, like why you couldn't just like steal that money, like, and leave them frozen. You know, like, oh, they're bloodthirsty, but also they're very meticulous about the law. And so they need to wake up these people and throw them into a meat grinder, and then they can steal the money. You know, it's like, why? Like, just shut off the cryo thing, let them die, and then steal the money. You know, I thought that was confusing. And also, I feel like there was a passing reference, and maybe I misunderstood it, where Polly was like, they've had the technology to unfreeze us for 10 years or whatever. Mm-hmm. And they're like, who are you talking about? And they're like, oh, us, 500 years in the future. And I'm like, wait, what? So are we back to time travel, or is that a metaphor or a joke? I still don't really know what to take away from that.
Sure. I mean, I don't know. Now that you bring it up, I hadn't thought about it. I always assumed that this was actually taking place in the future. But I, you know, I also have questions, because it seems like the Memtech seems to be the only thing around, right? Like, they never run into other companies, or they never run into like government agents or anything like that.
Panacea too. Memtech and Panacea.
Oh, Panacea. That's right.
But they may be the same thing.
They could be. So like, as a result, you're right. Why would they need to freeze these people to take them to the future to kill them? I mean, like, they don't need to sign anything over, right? Like, if they had to sign something, it probably would have been part of the contract to get them frozen in the first place. So, you know, the fact that they had to wake them up really didn't make sense. To me, it didn't really matter, to be honest. Like, I think by this point in issue 5, I almost felt like the reason why these people were here didn't really make any difference to me. Because we had so many issues with no answers on any of that. And a lot of the story really focused on characters themselves, not necessarily the situation that they were in. So that didn't bother me whatsoever. And I know you felt differently. I don't know. I guess maybe we just read books differently, to be honest.
No, actually, my takeaway to that point is I think the premise is super appealing. And I love sci-fi. I feel like maybe the kind of intellectual sci-fi like doesn't necessarily pay off because they don't really explore those aspects beyond just the premise. They don't really dig into, well, what is happening. You know, it's kind of like done in shades at best, but I actually really enjoyed sci-fi action and all of the character stuff. Mm-hmm. I thought that each of the flashbacks for all of the characters, I thought all of those were satisfying stories. And I think that's kind of one of the stronger parts of the series. You know, like, they gave more attention to that and less attention to but really what is happening, you know? Mm. Like, that's for us to fill in the gaps in, but we do know who these characters are.
Yeah, right. All right, fair enough. You want to rate this one up?
Yeah, I think I'll go 4 out of 5.
Yeah, I'm right there with you, dude. I've dug this series though in the entire time. I think maybe the second issue I didn't like as much, but I think the rest are pretty damn solid. Or maybe it's the third issue, wasn't that strong for me. But outside of that, I think the series is really strong. The premise is interesting. I think the story delivered, even though it was a little confusing. I think this issue had a nice payoff to the whole series, so I enjoyed it.
The art too, man.
Yeah, like, yeah, Hayden's art's fantastic.
Can't ignore that, because that's one of my favorite parts, is just the art and the colors I thought were really strong. And it's like, to me, it reads like a really good heavy metal story or something, you know?
Oh, yeah.
In kind of the best way.
It does have that, that Judge Dredd vibe too, right?
Yeah, they're all wearing the Dredd helmet.
Yeah. Yeah, I dig that. This is totally unrelated. Have you read the new Judge Dredd book, Under Siege?
Not yet, no.
All right, you should check it out. It's really good. All right, let's go to the final book of the week. This is, finally, Shipwreck number 6. No, your ears do not deceive you. You heard that correctly. Shipwreck number 6 is out. Written by Warren Ellis.
I was surprised as you.
Yeah, I didn't think it was going to be out so quick when they announced it. Written by Warren Ellis with art by Phil Hester. And let's talk about this. It's been so long since we've talked about Shipwreck. Let me ask you first. Did you go back and reread the previous 5 issues?
Yes.
You did?
I first I read this issue and I'm like, wow, I forget everything that... that happened before this. And that's not uncommon, but for this one especially, you have to acknowledge the lapse of time between issues 5 and 6.
So I'm gonna tell you, I did not read issues 1 through 5, or reread I should say, partially on purpose. I figured that when we recorded, either you or Ronnie would have read the previous 5. So I wanted to see if we had different perspectives on this issue based simply on that. So since you read all these back to back, tell me about the book. How'd you feel about this final issue?
I thought it was pretty satisfying, actually. I mean, there's certainly stuff that's left open, you know, like for me, I think the big piece that you have, I guess, is, basically the rescue mission shows up. The payoff, I guess, is that Shipwright carves the word saboteur into Isham's back and sends him back to our Earth. Mm-hmm. And so that basically is confirmation that, like, hey, this worked, but, you know, we all died because of this guy who's now in your custody. So, I mean, it definitely, I think, leaves off in an enticing place where you're like, well, where's this going to go now, you know? Like, should you assume that, since they understand the technology works, they don't really know that it's a hospitable place for them to colonize to, mm-hmm. you know? They could choose to send another mission, and, you know, they, I guess, would land on this place that is, like, pretty uninhabited, but also there's, you know, not a lot going on there. You know, like, might not be the most hospitable place to live, but, you know, if they are still committed to the forward escape premise, then I would assume that they could still continue.
Sure.
And I thought also one of the interesting things for me was kind of a question of what's going on with Shipwright at the end of the issue. Because he kind of, after he sends the dude off, is just like, oh, I'm going to run away.
Mm-hmm.
And they spend a lot of time throughout the series establishing that, hey, he's a coward and he just wants to be alone. I don't know. My personal reading is that in the final panels of the issue or whatever, basically we see him using the apporter and running away to Titan, where he dies on the surface of the moon.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I guess, potentially there's other people that are going to start coming to this world, and he can't take that, you know? Like, he was planning to come to here and never return because he wanted to be alone. But now that he knows that people might follow, he's not down with that.
Interesting. See, so I didn't get that. I want to say, first of all, that I thought this issue was absolutely brilliant. I read it like three times, twice without reading any of the words, because I think, and you know, when we were reading this when it was coming out regularly last year, the one thing that I said was, I don't think Phil Hester has ever done such brilliant work as he's done in this book. And I'm not necessarily talking about, like, individual pages or panels, but the amount of atmosphere that he brings into the story, the amount of, the level of imagination that he brings into some of the stuff is really fantastic. Like, there's some panels where, like, I think somebody doing a more traditional panel layout would do, like, I don't know, five or six panels on the page, and he does, like, one full page, and you can tell that each of these things would normally be a different panel, but melds them together so well, that I thought it was just absolutely brilliant. The coloring here is fantastic. Like, the art is, for me, exceptional. Like, for a high concept sci-fi story, this is perfect. There, obviously, there's horror elements. I think this works great as a horror type book as well. For me, this final issue was brilliant. I did not reread the first five before I read this. I did not reread the first five after I read this. I probably will in a few weeks. I'll go back and read 1 through 6 altogether, and see that progression. But I think this last issue, I somehow remembered a lot of the key points on who these people were and how they were connected. So I wasn't lost in any way, shape, or form. I really dug the fact how we got this payback with Ishram. You mentioned sending him back to Earth with the traitor thing or saboteur thing carved on him. I thought that was brilliant. I think the one thing we differ on is what the ending means. And you definitely have, I think, maybe a more solid answer as to what it means than I do. I didn't get that he used the apporter to go to Titan to kill himself. I understand that he was trying to escape his situation on Earth, and that's why he wanted to be here and maybe never come back. But I don't know if he's doing this because he can't handle other people showing up. I almost took it like, you know, when he and Isham were talking, Isham's like, this is the place where you're supposed to be. This is your home. And the way that I took the ending is that he accepts the fact that this is where he needs to be, because there will probably be never be other people showing up. And now he's free from all that. And I think that's why in that last panel, he turns to the flock of crows, or murder of crows, I guess you would call them. He turns to the murder of crows because he's free from all that. He is finally home, and he can live his life the way he wants it. And I'm not convinced that anybody on Earth will ever send another mission here because of what he did with Isham. I think if I send a mission somewhere to see if a place is viable, and that ship comes back to me with somebody that says saboteur on it, and the rest of the crew is missing, I would automatically assume that the trip itself made him insane. And whoever else I would send to this place would become insane as well. And I don't know if I would risk that thing on that kind of mission with more people.
Well, he couldn't have carved the word saboteur into his own back, you know? I assume.
Like, no,
that's
you're
pretty
right.
Talented.
You're right.
So I think there's an implication that he's the saboteur. It's a message that's being sent. And my reading also is that, like, the ship that they sent here in this issue and then goes back was empty. Like, it was there to pick up people.
Yes.
That would come back. You know, it was like a lifeboat or something. But they didn't send another manned ship to go pick these people up. So the people back on Earth understand that this thing showed up on this other Earth, and this guy ended up into it, who has a message carved on his back that he was a saboteur. So they're like, we get that this worked, you know. So I guess it's the question then about whether it's worth doing more. And I would assume probably that depends on the motivation of, like, how much people are invested in the whole idea of the forward escape, which seems to really be Shipwright's idea, right?
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that whole idea was really just a fabrication for somebody to help him create the technology to apport off of Earth and never come back.
Sure. Yeah, I see what you're saying. It is complicated. And I don't think we'll ever see a volume 2 of this, just based on the fact that it took so long to get from issue 5 to 6. I don't think we'll ever see a volume 2 unless somebody else picks it up, you know? Like, I would love for Phil Hester to do a volume 2 just by himself. I think he could do just as brilliant a job as Warren Ellis did with the writing. Because I think Phil really is a huge part of what makes this book great for me, you know? And part of me, like, doesn't even want answers. Like, I'm pretty content with the way that it ended, you know? I would love to see more, because I really love this insane world. But I'm okay with the ending. I thought it, for me, it was a nice finite ending.
Yeah, I agree. I think that, you know, it definitely closes things up in a way that leaves for discussion, you know, and that's not a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, I think, kind of jumping off that you know, the maybe written stuff and the dialogue, you know, is a little bit understated, and that the art does a lot of the heavy lifting and storytelling.
Yep.
So, you know, like just on its own merits, the art is incredible, but, you know, I think it works for the type of story that they're trying to tell here, that they are leaving these questions for you to discuss. They're not spoon feeding it to you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I generally tend to like stories better when they're not spoon fed to me. When I can kind of make my own assumptions about what happens. But obviously, like, you need to provide me with some kind of like puzzle pieces to put together. You know what I'm saying? Which I think some writers aren't quite capable of doing sometimes. But for me, this really worked. I mean, I love Shipwrecked all throughout, and I'm glad we finally got to see the final issue, and for me, it was very much worth it.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, like, I think for me, it's impossible to recommend something that is an unfinished story, you know?
Yeah.
Right. And now we have an ending. So, like, I think I would recommend this to people that want kind of a strange, trippy, you know, sci-fi story. Would you recommend it to
This is gonna read so fantastic in trade, like having all six issues together. Yeah, absolutely. If you like weird, trippy stuff, kind of like old school Vertigo stuff, I think this is gonna be right up your alley. Let's rate it up.
Yeah, you first.
Well, I mean, it's a 13 out of 5. I thought it was brilliant. I loved everything about this book. I don't know if part of my high score is because I've been eagerly anticipating this final issue. But I just absolutely loved everything about it. I need to talk to Phil about getting some pages from this issue.
Nice, Dean. Yeah. I'm with you, man. I'm going to go 5 out of 5. It's been one of my favorite series from Aftershock, actually. And, I'm pretty satisfied with this as the ending for it, you know.
Yep.
It's definitely, very compelling and complicated story. I think it really works, and it's nice to have it all finished.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Totally. All right. That wraps it up for all the book discussion. Next week, we have a plethora of books to talk about. It looks like we've got Baby Teeth, number 11, Betrothed, number 4, and Ronnie's favorite book, A Walk Through Hell, number 2. So that should be an interesting one as well. If you want to get in touch with us...
Yeah, sounds like a good
week. Oh, yeah, absolutely. If you want to get in touch with us, you can find us all on Twitter. Travis is at The Great Magnet. Ronnie's at Rombar316. I'm at Geekvine. Where else can we find us? I think that's the best place. We have email. There's like a Facebook group or something. But I prefer Twitter, so let's just leave it at that. Find us all on Twitter. Of course, the show is at Aftershock Pod. We'll catch you next time.
Shock the world.